This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Jessica Brad. She's a branch manager at the Grand Rapids Public Library and received a 2016 Library Journal Mover and Shaker Award for her work on public school public library partnerships. You can find her on Twitter at WhimsyLibrarian. Circulating Ideas is produced with the support of the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and listeners like you. So Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
I wanted to start with a really serious question, and that is, what is your biggest fandom?
Oh, man. Woo!
If you had to pick your biggest one.
I think I'm in the Marvel Universe a lot.
Okay.
Harry Potter up until adulthood was probably like the one that shaped me. Lord of the Rings is probably another huge one. And sometimes I like the really small ones, like Misfits was a UK show.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always like any fan fiction or any memes around the Misfits. I'm like, yes.
So do you like really get into them like that? I mean, do you go in and read the fan fiction and all that kind of stuff? And
yeah, so Tumblr was perfect for a lot of times back in the day. I used to save like all the wallpapers and all the pictures, but that was like back in the AOL like dial-up days. So I lost a lot of stuff when your like computer doesn't work with you.
Yeah.
So I felt like the digital hoarding first. Like I'm sort of a Pinterest person, but not as much as I am or used to be before I got super busy. It was Tumblr with my fandoms, whether it was a TV show. I ship a lot of people, and yeah, that was sort of where we could like geek out and nerd out and be cool with along with each other. So it was nice to finally have this world where you weren't alone. Or like when I used to watch Buffy or even Roswell, and you just really didn't have anyone to talk to outside of the people at your school. So you didn't know, like, no one watched it. You were just like this weird person. So it's nice to know. That's what I love about Twitter now with even the live TV show tweeting, that you get to see, like, I am not alone in the world in my nerdiness.
Yeah, because I mean, pre-internet, I mean, people obviously had all these things that they loved, but then you were just that nerd over there in the corner with maybe two or three other kids. Now you realize there's a whole world of people who like the same things that you do. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And it's really nice to find other librarians. For some reason, I've never been into Doctor Who. I couldn't get on board. Mostly from that Star Trek, Star Wars, I'm pretty significant in.
Do you feel like you're kind of interest in this kind of fandom thing helped you connect with kids back when you were I know you're a branch manager now, but back when you were a youth librarianship, do you think that helped you connect with them?
Yes, pop culture to me is huge. If you're not part of the conversation, then you have a really hard time like wooing kids over to discover why the library is so cool. So it was very interesting to just see it sort of fit in like a puzzle piece where, because I've gotten a lot of kids who specifically came, actually one of the best memories I have, when Rise of the Guardians, that movie came really popular among like older teens. And I had a few girls come in looking for the specific book surrounding like the Guardians of the Galaxy's background. And so I was asking them, had they read any of the fan fiction and Archive of Our Own, as just like completely point blank, like, hey, you guys seem like you're doing a lot of research. It might be going into a fan fiction. And they just like introduced, it was like really cool because they had this huge knowledge of what was going on in that fandom. And we had a lot of kids during, is it NaNoWriMo, that would try to write as part of their goals for their fan fiction. And then it was also great to link, like, Rainbow Rahl wrote the book Fangirl. So it was nice to bring that in to let them know that as much as we love these, like, safe characters, and you have this author that's created this world, and even though it can get a gray area, you've been given, like, the liberty to play around with these characters, don't get stuck in that world, because a lot of you have creative juices that you could create whole other worlds. And so it was really nice to link, like, authors who delve a little bit into that subject and link them with original fiction that they like based on what they read in fan fiction.
Yeah, I've always thought of kind of people who write fan fiction that it's almost like if you're an artist and you're tracing somebody else's drawings, you're sort of learning the structure and learning how things work. So
yes, and I'm not trying to, like, genderify it. I had went over a lot of, on the opposite scale, I love video games, and I have a PS3. I'm really into this mobile game right now. And I had to use my gaming knowledge. Like, I was old school, where my brother and I would print out the guides off the computer, and he would be playing while I'd be reading to him as we try to figure out, like, Prince of Persia and even, like, Splinter Cell, of, like, how to stuff like that. So I had to use, like, my gaming to woo over a lot of, to initially a lot of boys. And then also discover that there's, like, this whole underworld of girls, because all of my best friends, they play video games. A lot of my girlfriends, they have Twitch channels where they're streaming. So it's really nice when there's always this, like, subculture going on with girl gamers. There's still this stigma. So it's nice to not only reach the boys who are out and about gaming, but also the girls that are more doing it. Like, I would just not tell people I game. So it would be nice to be able to connect with just teens in general on all these pop culture levels.
Well, it's nice, as like you said, for you as an adult to show, look, I am a female, I play games, I enjoy games. So that means you teenage girls, you all can also enjoy this, and there's no stigma.
Yeah.
There should be no stigma for this.
Exactly. And you don't have to lose a lot of times there's a societal pressure that's sort of insidious for girls to conform, and you should only like these things. And so I always like the fact that if you want to like those things, it's awesome. If you don't, and you want to be that girl in the back that goes home and reads comic books and plays video games, you can be her. I was her, and, like, now it's cool. So it's, like, you know, it's great if you want to wear it openly. You're more than welcome to.
and you can always wear two hats, because, like, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she loves all the Disney princess stuff, but she's also begging us every night to watch another episode of The Flash on Netflix and stuff.
Yes, so, I mean, yes.
She covers the whole basis.
So. Yeah, so, and I felt like I had an older brother, so we had to share everything, and he was 4 years older. So he was very adamant about what he would and wouldn't watch. So I would have to negotiate, like, TV time. So I'm still very much, like, both of us love a good action movie. Like, I didn't really even get into, rom-coms until I was, like, I was in college. So I feel like you can do the whole spectrum and be true to yourself.
So how did you get into librarianship in the first place? What interested you in it kind of early on, like, made you want to go get that as your career?
Yeah, so just this past week, the woman who introduced me to librarianship, she just passed. Her name is Dorothy Evans, and I'm from Chicago. She worked for the Chicago Public Library, and the area that I lived in, it was the south side of Chicago, and basically all we had was the library. So my parents would take us there all the time, whether it was the early literacy programs that weren't framed that way at that time, or, like, the summer programs. And I remember asking her 300 times. There was this one book I loved to read, and I would ask her about it, and every time she would go show me where the book was. And it was never a experience of like, oh, you know, I can't believe you're asking for the same book again. I was always this fresh new time, even though it was the same book. I was like, I'm surprised they didn't drive her crazy. And I one day I asked her, how did I was like, I want to do that. I want to help people. And I asked her, how did she get behind the desk? And she told me that I needed a master's degree. And I was like, I don't even know what that is, but I'm going to get one. And then I sort of like grew up at the library back before there were sort of like ages on volunteering. I volunteered during the summer at about 10 or 11. And she she had a granddaughter, and she would take both of us to these ALA luncheons she served on a variety of committees. So she would take us to the awards breakfast or luncheons. And then anytime she would get books signed by authors, she would sort of give back, and she was always giving me and her granddaughter books to read. And so it's sort of when I kind of got the grasp on, okay, I need a bachelor's and then a master's, I was set on that. If anything, I wanted to work with people like me. I wanted to work in a population where it is underserved, and I wanted to give back the same way that she gave back to me.
And when did you get interested in having youth services sort of as your focus?
So when I went into library school, so let me preface that. My bachelor's was in music education.
Okay.
And I really loved teaching elementary music, or even like the Head Start music. And my professors would always say, like, I can't believe we're going to like lose you. And you like, you don't want to be a music teacher. So I knew that I wanted to always work with the younger kids. And we had to do a split in our teaching, our student teaching. We had to teach both elementary and high school. It's just required. Uh-huh. And I felt like the little kids were just such a joy to work with and introduce music. I was like, I'm definitely up to the teens were just funny and awkward, whether it was like middle school or a high school choir. So I was sort of set on this path that if I went into public services, I would stick with the youth.
And then when you're at Grand Rapids, you were part of a partnership called DigiBridge. Can you tell me about that? Because that's a partnership between the library and the public schools, which I think a lot of us in the public libraries are trying to do, get in with the public schools, and it sounds like it was a resounding success for you guys.
Yeah. When I was hired, we did not have a working relationship with the schools, nor did any of the school kids even come to the library. And where our downtown library is located, we were surrounded by at least two schools. And I remember when I first started planning programs, I would get no one. And that was sort of like the status quo. Yet when school was out, I would see kids walking, you know, over the library, under the library, around the library, but never like in the library.
Right.
So I was like, man, there has to be some way to bridge that, like, you know, disconnect, or, you know, what is it, the perception of the library in the community that the students don't want to come into the library. So I grabbed a stack of flyers of the programs that were happening for teens and for kids. And let me preface this by, at first I had started cold calling and cold emailing teachers and principals to see if there was an in. And the district there's about 17,000 teachers, students, and, you know, like employees. So it's not a small district by any means. So there would be no answer. And I always my thing is that if one way doesn't work, you know, you keep trying until you get a resounding no or hopefully a maybe. and then you can give it a while and maybe it'll turn into a yes. So I wasn't easily discouraged because both of my parents are teachers. So I understand the pressures that there are on educators. So I was hoping maybe it would turn into an easy road in, but it didn't. So I wasn't discouraged by any means. So after there was like 2 months of that, and so that day when I was like looking at these kids, I like had my stack of flyers and I called the library media services and explained to them who I was and if I could meet with someone that like ran the department. And they hooked me up for a meeting. And I came in with a stack of flyers and just, we had a very long conversation about they couldn't get kids into their school library and we couldn't get kids into the public library. And so what were their needs and how could we help support and address their needs? So she asked me, she called and contacted me maybe like a week later and asked me if I could essentially write up a paper of all the services that we offer that could help help out the library and their students. And then she would do her best to pass that on. So I completely did that and sent it to her. And so she championed it up all the way to the assistant superintendent and the head of like curriculum. So it was just a very random day, get a call, and she's like, can you be here for this meeting with this person? And granted, that backstory is I moved to Michigan for this job. I had never been to Michigan, never visited Michigan. I didn't know anyone in the organization, so a name didn't mean anything to
right.
me on my end. I was like, okay, I just got a meeting with this person. So when I sent it out to the supervisor at the time and it trickled up, they were flabbergasted because this was like someone who was really high up that they couldn't get meetings with.
But you broke through.
right. And I know it was like, it was sort of this like crazy side eye because they were like, you haven't even been here this long. You really don't know all the services. We're going to have to train you. And it's so true. Looking back on it, I was like, this is crazy. So I had to have separate meetings because I was still in the probationary period where they were, you know, I'm just still finding out youth services and figuring out the organization. I went in with this meeting, and then you can kind of read people in a meeting, one-on-one for me, in the fact of it, are they receptive to what you're trying to sell? Or you need to listen. It's sort of that like playing back and forth of like, have they heard this before? Or are we really getting to like the root of the issue? And so it was sort of like, while she thought what we had was great, it wasn't really addressing the issues that were important to her or she felt were important to the school district. So I sort of went off script then and was just sort of like, what do you want from us? or, you know, what could we do that you would see the library as a support institution for your schools for the lack of certified librarians? Like, what can we give you that would help you out?
Right.
If this was a wish list, because granted, you know, I'm like the new higher end. I was like, I don't know what I can do.
Let me just offer you everything.
And I'm sure I'll get in trouble and I say that like lightly as far as like, I don't, in my head, I'm like, I don't even think I can say yes, but
right.
And have these expectations of like that we could provide these services. But if this was a wish list, like just tell me what you want. And essentially she wanted her students to have access. And that was a big thing, was access. So I was able to take that back, and my library director championed top down of what do we need to do to get these kids access. If that's what's important to them, and we can go and start having those really hard conversations, both in-house and with the schools, of like, what do we need to do to work with them? And we had some, at the initial forming of the team, we had one of the other, he was a new hire, and from DC as a director of like innovation, and he was like, we have to name this. And he was like, trust me, like, if we name this, like, you know, everyone will be invested. I remember we spent a meeting where we were sort of like, I can't believe we're actually sitting down and like dedicating a meeting to naming it. And I'm really happy that we did, because people did find pride and investment in like, this is not sort of, this is an actual thing that is happening, and not sort of like, oh, we just met one time and, you know, it didn't sort itself out, or we're just doing something. So I'm really happy that he was instrumental in getting the ball rolling to forming this group.
Yeah, when I was researching this stuff to talk to you, I saw there's like a video somebody made of you and your director and some people from the schools talking about the program. And at one point, your director was kind of like, hey, we tried for years to get in with those schools, and then Jessica just came in and did it. We're not really sure what she did, but...
Yeah, I mean, I feel like on my end, and again, it goes back to that wish list of I tried at first. It's so easy to be like, we already have these services, and you know, where do we fit in with what you guys need, instead of saying like, I know we have these services, they're not meeting what you want, and just point blank, like, just tell, what do you want, and you know, what are your needs, and then taking that back to figure out, well, how do we address that,
right?
And that's really hard, especially when I know that people have worked, you know, hard on creating these services, and we have a lot of programs that we still continuously do that we've actually enhanced since this partnership. But for the initial part, to try to get another organization on board, sometimes we had to forego that for a second and say, hey, what can we provide that would make you guys kind of buy into the library and our mission?
And one of the things that came out of that was you did a teen technology camp. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the teen tech camp was our first program. And when we first had our initial meeting and we were going through this whole wish list, it was sort of a consensus that we needed to figure out if we could even like work together well. And someone suggested that over the summer, of course, there's like the summer reading program, but they were really concerned about sort of like a teen or tween thing happening. And they wanted to connect those kids so they sort of don't lose or avoid the summer reading loss, especially when they get into high school. And then there was this added factor of there were a lot of kids in the district that weren't able to have emerging technology yet, with exams and everything else, they're required to use these devices. So it was sort of a way, that was like another layer. And then the last layer was, would these emerging technology devices kind of entice kids who are reluctant readers? So there was like a lot going on. And the teen tech camp was planned in 6 weeks. And
wow, that's quick.
it was very quick. And the budget was outside of the devices, which we had gotten a grant from our library foundation for. The budget for the camp was like $400, because the extra caveat was like, we don't have money. As I feel like most libraries are familiar with.
Oh, yes.
I feel like when this is what makes or breaks you as a librarian, as a person. As much as I was like, man, I really wish we could be in a district overflowing with money. To me, it's a fun challenge to sort of leverage the resources and figure out, like, okay, we don't have anything. How do we make this an exciting, fun camp, and not have all the resources to do so? And then how do I use that to have the kids as well as myself advocate for the resources? So we had the devices, and that's a whole other segment on curating the titles and the platform management systems. But essentially, we loaded them with books that we felt would be appealing for middle schoolers. And then I picked one book from there to base the whole camp around. And then we would do activities linking those books. So I ended up pairing with, at the time, GVSU had a partnership with the schools with their film club. So I had like their film club crew come in with all their equipment so kids could record, green screen everything, and edit their videos. We wanted it to be a technology camp, but when you start pricing out the technology, it was like, whew, you know, we can't afford initially, like, to actually make it a full technology camp. But we had these like $8 robots that literally ran with batteries. And then, oh, and you know what? I was like, databases, because we're going to get some information literacy in there. And we ended up doing a whole kind of fun research training with the kids. But like, again, you have to make it fun. So the best thing about the end of the camp was how much the kids thought this was like the best camp ever, even if it had terrible technology. the parents we have the funniest we've had, like, the parents' summary where they're like, our kids would not stop talking about the library and like how much fun they had, making it. I'm like, man, they had fun making $8 robots, and they had fun learning about databases and about how to research. They had fun with the film crew. So making. And then what I would do at the end is I would tell them, like, hey, guys, I know this isn't probably what you were expecting. And I know that there's, like, cooler technology out there. And the only way we can get that money is if you tell them, like, we need this money because look at this. Like, we should have better. Can you imagine what we could do if we had, like, $20,000? So I would have the kids write not only, like, what they learned to use that as, like, this this academic scholarly tidbit, but also like why, you know, this is why we need more and what they could do with more. That did translate into, I think at the end, it was like a $22,000 grant where we were able to take all those terrible $8 robots and switch them out for Lego Mindstorms and little bits. And then we were able to take those old black and white Nooks and switch them out for Kindle Fires. Teen Tech Camp was, on the staff end, a huge learning curve because I didn't know anything about robotics, but that was what was trending. And I don't mean like trending, but it's what the school was passionate about, and they were having a lot of robotics teams. So I was like, okay, we're going to have to learn about robotics, because I can't afford to hire anyone. And eventually we had, the very last one that we did, we had our adult reference, I think, department hooked us up with a, robotics team, and we had the money to like partner with, other organizations, but at this time we didn't. So it was like we had to learn in-house about robotics. And like I don't have a degree. Not a
Right.
roboticist. I was like the most I was familiar with it was Robopocalypse by Dan Coyle. And yeah, so that was very interesting. And then having to train staff to muddle enough where we could make a comprehensive curriculum. But again, we were like, oh, we are not experts.
Well, and part of the partnership that I think we didn't specify is that the kids also, and the teachers and staff also got digital cards.
Yes. So our very first initiative was again that whole access. And at that time, the schools did not have access to databases, or they didn't have the money. It was very costly, to access databases. They realized that more and more research, especially with current or in the last couple years, you can find it much easier on a scholarly database than you can find in a book. And so it was like kids' topics, where were they finding the information if they were doing it on a social, a societal rule or controversy. When they came to us, they were saying that a lot of times the kids couldn't even check out books because their library cards, they didn't know where they were. Their parents had maybe abused them. So they had all these reasons why they couldn't access our databases. So our director went and championed it with, at the time, the librarian who was the head of, she did all the database contracts. We had a huge restructuring, so now our collection services department, the head of that is over the databases. But at this time, there was another librarian, Jean, who was handling all those contracts. So she had to go and talk to them about this whole issue and initiative we were trying to do, and then see what that would look like. And then the schools had to bring in their lawyer and some people on their team to make sure, like with privacy data sharing and stuff like that, that they don't get any lawsuits or, they're not violating any laws. So the databases with the library cards, that was a huge initiative that took like everyone in multiple departments, both in the library and the schools, to do. And then we launched that in the fall. We created a portal that was, and we called it GRPS Connect. And essentially, we were able to roll in their student ID as their digital library card. And one of the issues around that is because we don't filter, so we couldn't make it an all access digital card because of the ebook portion on the like OverDrive and stuff like that. And I know other libraries have had models where they do that, but we it was one of the things we were passionate about that we did not want to do, so we had to find a compromise. So those were a lot of like conversations, hard conversations we had to have on both sides to figuring out what do we do with that. So the initial thing they're doing right now is that the students have access to our databases, but then we would also go into the schools at orientation, at open houses, and we would do library card drives where we would sign kids up for full, we call them full access cards. So if they wanted to do the streaming or the ebooks, they could do that. And then we also had to train initially when we released and launched that initiative. We had to go into each school, the principal meetings district-wide, and do a lot of overhaul training to make sure everyone is familiar with the portal and GRPS Connect. And that right there helped start solidifying that they see us. We are not these like weird, shadowy figures. People now know and can pinpoint people at the library. and ended up being like the best thing that ever happened to us, because we were able to connect on the floor and one-on-one with whether it was teachers or principals, where they sort of let go of whatever stigmas or stereotypes, where now we get principals, we do get teachers, we get students that are more apt to come into the library and use us, just by having a presence at the school.
Well, and as a result of this program, you were honored with a Library Journal Mover and Shaker Award. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. How
was it to get that call about that?
It was very weird. It was weird, and it was really completely unexpected, because anything I feel that you do in the library world, I had an intense passion, and I didn't know that. I guess, in all honesty, you don't know what people are watching you,
right?
or taken the initiative to nominate you. So that was just, it was just a shock. Have the work, and it made all the trials and tribulations, they call it, like, worth it.
Right.
And the nights spent crying and adjusting to not only the library world, but just navigating two organizations, it completely helped validate, I feel personally, the passion that I have for the work that I did.
Well, that's great. So the last thing I really want to talk about is the one of the other big projects I think you're involved with, and that's the Libraries for Black Lives.
Yes.
Can you talk about how you got started with that? So, I mean, I assume it came out of the Black Lives Matter movement and then just sort of the library response to that?
Yeah. So there was last summer the huge instances, and I'm going to only list two of the many, but Philando Castile and Alton Sterling.
Yes.
And that were murdered by police, where they caused a huge uproar in communities both where they were from, and it reverberated around the nation. And so usually when stuff like that happens, we know, like, okay, we're going to put a book list out, or we're going to have to have, like, a sort of in-house conversation if, depending on even where your library is located. I had a friend who's a manager on another side of town where, like, the library is the community conversation. Like, people are coming in wanting to express their frustration or their anger or their sadness, or, like, what do I tell my children? So you have librarians sort of getting all this sort of echoes. Depending on where they're located. So how do you handle that? And what do you do outside of sort of what we usually do? So I had a friend that I met at PLA through the Movers and Shakers. And she, Amitha Alonio, did the Voices of Race. And she talked about how she wanted to make sort of, or if I was interested in helping create sort of initiative where we can have these hard conversations in librarianship regarding issues that affect the Black community. And it was sort of like just an organic conversation. And then after the last murder, it became real, where through email, she connected to other librarians and was like, what are we going to do? So we saw that out of that, there came Black Lives Matter, but then also, and that started, like, since Ferguson, but then there was this other movement called the Movement for Black Lives, which it, underneath it, it has Black Lives Matter and a ton of other organizations, like the Food Justice Initiative, and there's many, many organizations under this broad umbrella.
Right.
And so we saw, like, in the museum make a statement, and the law for libraries, they put out a statement. And so we were sort of like, how could we revolutionize the library world if we made a statement. And on the back end of that, I had our city contacted our library director saying that the Chamber of Commerce wanted to hold a community conversation. And because it was so quick, would the library be willing to host that discussion? And our library has done a fantastic job system-wide of programming these really hard conversations. So that was in a great, awesome recognition that the city's like, we could count on the library where we can hold these conversations. So that was sort of also that I had on the back end. So we put together this Libraries for Black Lives, sort of a following the movement for Black Lives, taking a pledge, and then figuring out what we could do in the library world to sort of create a space of equity. It was intense after we released it. We just did a community conversation in partnership with the Atlanta Public Library. And one of the things we did is we wanted to model a community conversation around certain points in the huge movement for Black Lives. They came out with a 40-point plan. So we just took a point to model that, to see what does it look like having these really tough and difficult conversations around the example that we used was divest, invest, where you take away from the militarization budget of police officers, and what could you do to put that into early prevention programs, or what does that look like? What does that advocacy look like? And it was very, very interesting. I mean, there were tears. It was emotional, but it was a huge learning experience, both for all of the Library for Black Lives presenters, as well as everyone in the audience, that we're still working on being open on both sides to having these very frank and honest discussions. So that being said, and I just listened to Jason Reynolds speak. He came through for All American Boys, and I hate that we have to do this, but he had to make a statement saying he's not anti-police, because most people think that if you take a stand And I'll say personally, this has been my interaction with police. So I was recently engaged, and we got pulled over. We were at my to-be sister-in-law's house, and we were leaving the house, and we got pulled over by the police because they said I didn't have my turn signal on. And then when we started talking to them, they thought I was a prostitute and that I had picked up. It was very, very interesting. And that wasn't even my first rodeo. So when I talk about the hypersexualization of Black girls that has started since I was 16, and my parents had to have a different talk than they had with my brother, but it's a reality that I've lived in and had to live in. So, sometimes I just have to preface that.
Right, right.
It's the policing procedure that until now my husband had never seen anything like that before. And so that was a complete shock of you're instantly thought of as a criminal, which is completely new experience. So that's why Libraries for Black Lives is passionate from family experience and my own personal experience. It's really a call to have more people to go beyond just here are the book lists and right. Here are a few programs, but actually having those conversations, whether it's policy or a frontline staff bias. But how can I use wherever I'm at to make sure that I don't cause a perpetuation of racist practice or tendencies in the work that I do.
Well, I hope people continue to, and I hope you all continue to be active with it and keep pushing it. I know you said you just did something with Atlanta. Do you have anything else specific coming up with Libraries for Black Lives?
Yes, we will be briefly at the Digital Public Library Conference. I think that's in Chicago, talking about what we're working on, hopefully to unveil this summer. I think we'll be a year. So we're working towards that. We've now gotten to the point where we're able to pull in more members to actually start working on more initiatives that we want to see come to fruition. And then I think we might be doing a little bit at ALA annual, but I might be wrong with that. but for right now, I know we're definitely going to be in DPLA, Digital Public Library. Yeah, I was like DPLA and Chicago. So.
All right. Well, if people wanted to get in touch with you to learn more about you or Libraries for Black Lives or anything else, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, sure. So Twitter, I'm very much in that space. So at Whimsy Librarian. So please, you can tweet at me if you are interested, whether in Libraries for Black Lives or also anything with partnership between school and public libraries. Then you can also reach me at whimsylibrarian@gmail.com.
All right, Jessica, thank you so much, and have a great day.
All right, thanks, Steve. Bye.
Bye. Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. You can help others find the show by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.